On this week's edition of New York Now, we'll speak with the Citizens Budget Commission to discuss Medicaid funding, cuts to the CDPAP program, and health initiatives in the state budget. Then we look at how electric school buses are being used to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and the work being done by NYSERDA to ensure the state is on track to meet its goals. I'm Chantal Desha, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation.
I will fight like hell for you every single day, like I've always done and always will.
Get another stand.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Chantal Destra. This week, there were major protests on college campuses around the country regarding the ongoing war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. As an alum of Columbia University and a native New Yorker, I, like a lot of New Yorkers, was interested in what was going on the campus. In the last few weeks, students set up encampments in an effort to push the university to divest endowment funds from companies they say are profiting from the war. But things escalated this week when protesters took over a building on the university's campus. Not too long after, the police department was called to clear the demonstrators. When speaking with reporters, New York City Mayor Eric Adams said nearly 300 people were arrested Tuesday night. And Governor Kathy Hochul has continued to underscore the need for protests to remain peaceful.
Every American has a First Amendment right to peacefully protest and assemble. And many students we know have very strong convictions, strong beliefs about what has taken them to protest. We don't have to agree with them. That's not always how it is. But when actions cross over into vandalism, harassment, destruction of property, or even violence, then the line has been crossed.
Columbia isn't the only university in New York with ongoing protests. There were also demonstrations at Fordham University and at City College and a few SUNY campuses, but we'll continue to monitor the situation. Now turning to another topic. The state budget has officially been passed, and as we discussed last week, one of the biggest aspects of the budget is funding to Medicaid. This year's budget included savings for the program by way of cuts to the consumer-directed personal assistance program. That move sparked pushback from advocates and lawmakers. We sat down with Patrick Orecki of the Citizens Budget Commission to understand why Medicaid continues to have so much influence over the budget process. Here's that conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I wanted to start on Medicaid. The state budget provided savings to the Medicaid program by way of the cuts to the consumer-directed personal assistance program. There were a lot of opposition from advocates and lawmakers in the final days of the budget negotiations. So what is the commission's perspective on these cuts?
Yeah, well, Medicaid is the single largest program in the state's budget, so it's always going to be a source of big numbers on savings and on new spending. So it's something we're super focused on, and especially this CDPAP, the consumer-directed program, because it's a program that's growing at a pretty astronomical rate. You know, the figure that gets thrown around a lot is 1,200% over the last decade, which is a huge amount of growth. And the implication for the budget then is that you're growing at a rate that's not sustainable over the long term for the state and or crowding out spending in other priority areas of the budget. So it's something that I think is getting due consideration.
And as someone who has worked in the state budget office and has specifically focused on Medicaid, can you help us unpack what goes into the decision-making process when it comes to the Medicaid program in relation to the budget?
Yeah, again, since it's kind of number one with a bullet in the state spending pie, it's always going to get a huge amount of focus. And the difficulty there is that you have a program that's nearly $100 billion when you include state, local, and federal spending that's covering 6 million New Yorkers. About one in three New Yorkers is on Medicaid. So there's huge implications for no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. But managing that cost really makes or breaks the budget because you know, a couple percentage points difference in Medicaid is a couple billion dollars, so it matters a lot.
And when we look at the financial stability of the Medicaid program, what should the state should or could be doing to ensure that this isn't an issue year after year?
Yeah, I think it's always going to be an issue year after year. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of being proactive and looking long term. So the thing that we've been focusing on, for example, going forward under the governor's proposal, state share Medicaid spending was slated to go up about 7% annually going forward. That's a huge rate of spending growth. Frankly, mm-hmm. the tax base doesn't grow at 7% most years. So if you have your biggest program growing at 7%, again, you're crowding out other things or you're opening up budget gaps that you have to deal with somehow. Kind of the big concern for us is that that is 7% with the proposed savings that the governor put forward. Mm-hmm. So the fact that most of those were negotiated out, and in fact, a lot of new spending was added, means that rate of spending growth is going to be even higher in whatever the enacted financial plan looks like, which we don't have yet. But the concern is, how sustainable is that over the long term? 7% or more, frankly, is probably not.
So are there any untapped or underutilized resources that the state should be using to help with savings for the program?
Yeah, I think, you know, they're focusing on the right things. The areas that are growing really extraordinarily fast, like mm-hmm. personal care and home care services, making sure that those are targeted to the exact people that need it the most, because there is obviously a need and a growing need, but there are ways to manage the cost and find some savings as well. I think the other thing to think about is the hospitals landscape, right. which mm-hmm. is critically important. Again, some hospitals are truly absolutely struggling, have been for a long time. In the state developing a plan, which I think they'll hopefully do in earnest this year, for how to make those financially sustainable over the long term is another key thing.
And we know the state budget provided $3.2 billion to support those distressed hospitals. A lot of that money will come from the 1115 waiver. So do you think that amount is enough to help the 29% of New York hospitals that are currently facing financial difficulty?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that is an unanswered question at this point. One of the things that we're looking at, too, is the commission that the governor recently convened at the end of last year, mm-hmm. the Commission on the Future of Healthcare, and hoping that they do some of the work and publish the resources that we need to be able to analyze the scope and the size of that problem, which is absolute. I think the position that the state's been in for many years is sort of going from almost triage to triage on the right. financially distressed hospital situation, coming up with new programs, new supplemental payments, things like that, that get through a year or two. But we really need to have kind of a long-term comprehensive view at how to make sure these hospitals are financially sustainable and delivering the services that are needed.
And when it comes to that commission, what guardrails or benchmarks should be put in place to ensure that they're coming up with the best recommendation for the state?
Yeah, I think, first of all, speed is absolutely yes. critical. Mm-hmm. So we know that the intent is to have them issue their first set of recommendations by the end of this year to inform next year's budget. I think making sure that that deadline is met is absolutely important. Another thing we'd like to see from the commission, but also from the Department of Health and the Medicaid program more broadly, is much greater transparency. So, of course, we all want to come up with what the most effective and efficient solutions are in the Medicaid program. We can't do that without the data and the resources to actually analyze the problem and come up with the best solutions. So I think the commission should be very transparent, publish their work, publish the data that they use, but the Department of Health should do some of that as well, really improve that.
And do you think the state and the Department of Health has been receptive to the need for transparency?
I think the commission shows that they are interested mm-hmm. in it and maybe prioritizing it, but we need to see some follow through now.
Yeah.
As an example, last year there was legislation that would have required DOH to publish more data on home care and personal care services, which we supported, passed with flying colors through the legislature, was vetoed on the basis of having a bit of a cost. But we think that it's something that the state should be doing, not only for home care data, but Medicaid across the board.
And we know that Medicaid spending sort of ballooned through the course of the pandemic. So is there anything that the state should be doing in terms of proactive measures should there be another emergency health scare or another pandemic?
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons that costs really exploded during the pandemic, too, in the Medicaid program was that a lot of people enrolled into Medicaid. They lost jobs, and so they moved into Medicaid and stayed there under federal law changes that happened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A lot of those people have since moved out, so the cost will come down temporarily, but that long-term trajectory going forward is the thing that really is a concern.
And the state budget also included reimbursement for hospitals and nursing homes. There were a lot of opposition from labor unions who said that, you know, that amount that the state is proposing won't necessarily be enough to cover that cost. So what is the commission's position on that?
Sure. I think it's recognizing that not every institution or every provider's situation is the same. So when you mentioned financially distressed hospitals or safety net hospitals, their books look completely different from a much better off hospital. And they've been a concern for a long time. Again, the state's kind of papered its way through. But that universe of severely financially distressed hospitals hasn't changed. And the need for a comprehensive solution there is absolute. But again, you can't provide the same, you know, dollar support and supplemental payments from the state to every hospital because it's just not financially sustainable.
And now that the state budget has been passed, what are some other healthcare initiatives that the commission is going to be closely watching through the rest of the legislative session and the year?
Yeah, one thing that we're really kind of eager to see details on and concerned about as well is the proposed revenue raiser for the Medicaid program as well. It's a tax on the books, but it's really a way of the state trying to get more federal support. Our concern there is that it might only last for a couple of years if it's recognized at all, and that as soon as that money goes away in 3 or 4 years' time, the state will have a hole in its Medicaid budget that it can't sustain. So what we're looking at with that, with the Commission on the Future of Healthcare, with the data transparency, is the state kind of having a more absolute transformative plan rather than these are the resources to get us through next year. We can, you know, muddle our way through a couple more years with these resources, but in a couple of years' time, we're going to be back to the drawing board again. So hopefully avoiding some of that.
Well, there's certainly a lot to look forward to. We'll have to have you back on the show, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we were speaking with Patrick Oracki, Director of State Studies for the Citizens Budget Commission. And as Patrick underscored, the reality is so many New Yorkers rely on Medicaid. So funding for the program will likely continue to be a big portion of the state's budget in the years to come. You can find more information on state funding for Medicaid and other healthcare initiatives on our website. That's at nynow.org. Now turning to another topic. In 2022, the governor signed legislation that established a deadline for the state to transition to zero-emission school buses. Supporters say these efforts will help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve air quality. Under the Environmental Bond Act, funding was made available to help school districts across the state with the transition, which critics say can be costly. We spoke with Adam Reuter at NYSERDA about the work being done to reach the goal. Here's that conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Adam.
It's my pleasure.
And to start out, can you help us unpack the funding that was secured for electric school buses through the Environmental Bond Act?
Sure. So New York State has set a target of 100% of all new school buses purchased to be zero emission by 2027, and all school buses on the road to be zero emission by 2035. We know that currently electric school buses cost more than diesel equivalents, but to help with covering that cost, we've approved $500 million through Governor Hochul's Environmental Bond Act that was approved in 2022 that is going exclusively toward electrifying school buses. So this money is helping to reduce the cost to schools and to taxpayers of the of buying electric buses and the charging infrastructure that's needed to fuel them.
And we're about 2.5-3 years to 2027. So are we on track to meeting that benchmark?
You know, we've talked to schools from across the state and are helping schools across the state get toward this goal. And so one of the key things, the first step really is for schools to help develop an electrification plan, understanding what it's going to take for their school buses to electrify, what that means for the routes that they drive, what that means for the logistics, what technologies are going to work for the schools, what type whether they need power upgrades at their depot. So we're working with well over 100 school districts already on these electrification plans. And we encourage all schools to come to NYSERDA to help get help with this. We have money and can pay up to 100% of the cost of these studies. That's the first step. And so as I said, a number of school districts, a large portion of the school districts in the state are already doing this. We also have seen dozens of school districts that are taking the first step and buying their first few electric buses. That could be through our program, and we've seen a few dozen schools already apply since our program opened in just after Thanksgiving last year. And also through the federal money that's available through the Environmental Protection Agency. The Clean School Bus Program, we've also seen dozens of schools that are taking these first steps and trying to get funding through that program. So between all these actions, we see schools starting the process. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we want to see at this point. We know that we don't need to get to 100% tomorrow,
right.
But by taking these first actions, we think schools will be prepared and will have an understanding of how the buses work, what some of the challenges might be with the buses, what bus routes they're going to work on initially, and maybe which ones they might want to wait till a little later toward 2035 to electrify. But getting a sense of how this is going to work, how the buses work, how the technology works, making sure that your mechanics understand how they work and your bus drivers know how they work. That's really the first step. And we're seeing a lot of schools take advantage of that.
And one of the challenges has been the cost of purchasing electric school buses. There has been a lot of concern because it is very costly. So are there any plans to mitigate that challenge or any plans to help secure additional funding?
Through NYSERDA's New York School Bus Incentive Program, we can cover up to 100% of the difference in the cost between a diesel bus and an electric bus. And you know, this is really important because we don't want the impact of this to fall on local taxpayers. We want to help people get started on this process and really make sure that in these early days of the market, the buses are affordable and a viable option. We know that the cost will come down over time. The cost of batteries is coming down. And as the vehicle manufacturers ramp up production and these become more common, there will be economies of scale and the cost will come down. So we're really focused mm-hmm. on helping people get these first few buses into their fleet, figure them out, and covering the difference in cost as much as possible. As I said, we also offer money to cover the charging infrastructure. And then there are other programs like through the electric utilities, where the electric utilities can help to cover some of the electrical upgrade costs that are required or may be required as buses are electrified and you might need more power at your bus garage.
Some of the Republican lawmakers have said that they want to push back the deadline from 2027 to 2045 and instead implement a feasibility study to do a cost-benefit analysis of electric school buses. So what is your response to that course of action?
So last year, NYSERDA released an electric school bus roadmap, where we tried to really identify where the market is now and what has to happen to achieve the goals that the state has set. We think that lays out a good plan, and we're now acting on that plan. As I mentioned, many school districts are already doing feasibility plans to help them understand what it's going to take to electrify their fleets. So we have the money available for all school districts in the state to do this. We highly encourage them to do it, and planning process really only takes a few months to develop this plan. We think that that's really where people should be focusing right now.
And do you think awareness is a concern? Are there any plans to implement an awareness initiative to help garner more support for electric school buses across the state?
Awareness is a big challenge because with any new technology, there are concerns about the unknown. And so we want to help be out there helping not just the schools, but also the public understand the technology and understand what opportunities it brings. We have been speaking to schools across the state at both the transportation directors at the schools, the superintendents, the business officials, really all the, we've tried to reach all of the key decision makers at the school districts, including the school boards who play a key role as well, and bring factual, unbiased information to them, including where some of the challenges remain. You know, we think this works for a lot of folks and works for districts across the state, but, you know, maybe you don't use this for the hardest to electrify cases yet, and you focus on where it's going to be the easiest. But all that is about awareness. Mm-hmm. Similarly, for the general public, we are eager to reach everyone, and through, by one of the ways that we're doing that is through our Electric School Bus guidebook that we've developed. And this is really hands-on, user-friendly materials that explain some of the benefits of school buses. It explains electric school buses. It explains how to bring them into your operations, and it really tries to get at the typical questions that people have when trying to bring electric school buses into their fleet, to be a bit of a one-stop shop for information that's out there and publicly accessible for anyone who wants to try this.
So from your purview, is there anything that the state or lawmakers could be doing to help garner more support from New Yorkers?
The key thing that we're really focused on is getting information out there and getting factual information out there. We think that's really the key right now. You know, we have put a lot of money out there, and you know, $500 million is going to really be enough to get started across the state on this transition. But making sure that everyone is on the same page and understands the opportunities and understands the challenges, you know, is really going to be the biggest next step.
And what would you say to any New Yorker that was reluctant to using electric school buses? Are there any ways to help incentivize them?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of benefits to electric school buses, and it's not just about reducing greenhouse gases. It's also about health benefits and safety benefits and economic benefits. From a health benefit standpoint, diesel buses put out a lot of local pollution that especially can get sucked back into the bus and make the air on the bus more harmful for students to breathe. It can lead to increased asthma rates and other long-term health challenges for students. So eliminating that is going to be a major benefit of electric school buses beyond the climate benefits and energy benefits. There's also, electric school buses are a lot quieter than diesel buses. So mm-hmm. What we've heard repeatedly from school bus drivers that drive them is that they see this as a great safety benefit to make sure that they can hear incidents that are happening or starting on a bus before they get out of control. They can have more ability to focus on the road than on a diesel bus. So we've seen drivers really love this from a safety standpoint. And then also from an economic standpoint, it's important to recognize that while the upfront cost of school buses today is high, it is coming down, but there are a lot of operational savings. It's cheaper to drive them on a day-by-day basis, and they're lower maintenance. So we see schools saving money over time as they switch to electric buses.
And apart from electric school buses, what are some other areas that you're hoping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
The transportation sector is one of the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases in New York State. And we are working on not just electrifying the transportation, although we are working on electrifying cars and trucks and transit buses as well. But we're also working on expanding access to public transportation, providing more mobility options and making it easier for people to choose low carbon transportation options like biking or walking or taking the bus or, you know, and we recognize that this is really important, especially in lower income communities where it's always really expensive to own a car across the state. And making sure that people have good, reliable and other low carbon options is going to be really important for this broader mission.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of important work ahead, but we thank you for joining us here today. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for now, but thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
And we were speaking with Adam Reuter, Director of Clean Transportation for the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. And we'll bring you updates on the progress being made to transition to electric school buses in the coming years right here on the show. For more information and resources around the climate initiatives in the state, you can visit our website. Again, that's at nynow.org. Well, that does it for this edition of New York Now. Thank you for tuning in and see you next week.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.